something to say. I killed your baby today. It don't matter much to me as long as it's dead. I've got something to say. I raped your mother today. It don't matter much to me as long as she's dead. Sweet love and death, hey, waiting for your prayer. Come we get one last career.
This is Dr. Wally B. from Cat Daddy in the 1320s, and you are listening to WHFR Dearborn, Making Waves.
The following is an encore presentation of Sierra Club Radio.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotel.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with Janine Cotter, the CEO of solar installation company Luminant. We'll also speak with Rachel Butler, the national organizer for the Sierra Club's Green Transportation Campaign, about the increase in bike commuting. And Avital Andrews from Sierra Magazine will talk about whether or not it's possible to have green fast food. We're here now in our studio with Janine Cotter. She's the co-founder of an urban solar installation company called Luminant. Welcome.
Thank you.
Janine, I'm really interested to talk with you about your experiences with Luminant. You're one of a very few women in the country to be CEO of a solar installation company. And I'm wondering, how did you end up essentially founding a construction company?
Actually, I ended up founding a solar company because of a deep, long-held interest in renewable energy and because of some familial ties. My husband started in solar in 1981. That's when he built his first system. It was a 50 kilowatt grid-tied system many, many years ago in 1981. My parents founded an NGO that does sustainable development in the third world, mainly with indigenous populations. Dinner time conversation usually surrounded around renewables and solar. For an urban environment, for a built environment, is the most rapidly deployable clean energy technology. And thinking about wanting to work in an environment in which we live, my husband and I decided to start Luminant, which is an urban solar installation company.
And when did you start the company?
In 2004.
And so what does it mean to be a solar installation company?
So we design and we build solar electric systems on people's homes and on businesses and on nonprofits in the San Francisco Bay Area. What that means is that we put panels on people's roofs, taking a normal house and turning it into a power generator that uses clean energy from the sun to power the home.
Now, I know that there are different rules in different places, but in San Francisco and the Bay Area where you operate, are those solar panels primarily just powering that house, or are they also feeding energy back into the grid? Like, can people sell extra energy back to make money?
That's actually a really good question. The way that systems are sized in the state of California is really to offset the load on the house, the electrical usage of the house. Now, you're feeding power back into the grid, you're grid tied, so that the power that you generate from the sun, if your home isn't using that electricity, it's flowing back into the grid. Mm-hmm. And then you can pull that power off of the grid later mm-hmm. when power is cheaper. And that is one of the ways that it becomes financially really compelling to use solar, because you're net metering. You're mm-hmm. essentially using power like rollover minutes in a mm-hmm. cell phone. Mm-hmm. So you're not really selling it to the utility. You're building up credits that you can use against.
I like the rollover minutes analogy, because I think a lot of people have cell phones that, you know, they like to keep the minutes from month to month. And I like the idea of you can go on vacation and your house is generating rollover energy that you can use for free when you get back, right?
Yeah, I'd never really thought about it. But yeah, absolutely.
So when you do this kind of work, I'm sure you get a lot of questions about affordability.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are a lot of, mistaken ideas, misperceptions about solar energy, because when it first became, a topic of conversation in the 70s or the 80s, mm-hmm. it used to be quite expensive. Where are we at today in terms of cost?
So solar has gotten cheaper. Panels have gotten cheaper. We've gotten smarter. It has grown as an industry. It's developed much more. It's no longer dominated by a person in a truck going out and doing off-grid systems. We're actually an industry that's maturing. And so mm-hmm. solar as a technology and as installed solar has gotten much more affordable over time. The other thing that has happened is that ways that people can get access to solar in terms of not owning it themselves, instead leasing it, has come to the fore. And that has provided a variety of different ways that people can put solar on their home as opposed to just outlaying the cash up front.
Because when you lease it, you're essentially not, you don't have to make any down payment. You're just, I think it's around the same cost as your monthly energy bill. You're just doing it solar.
It can be. Yeah. I mean, the way that solar works is that you're offsetting your actual usage. So oftentimes people will call and they'll say, I have a 2,400 square foot home. How much is it going to cost for me to go solar? And the question that I ask is, well, how much do you use? How much electricity do you use? Because that's what you're replacing.
Mm-hmm.
You're generating clean electricity to offset what you otherwise would pay the utility for.
Mm-hmm.
And those panels are generating clean kilowatt hours. So you're buying, basically, when you're leasing, you're buying that power from the company that owns your panels, as opposed to paying that money to utility for a kilowatt hour, if that makes sense.
So right now, it's especially economical for people who have high electric bills.
Absolutely, because mm-hmm. we bill people for their electricity usage based on how much they use. And mm-hmm. the more electricity you use, the higher the cost. It's sort of like graduated income tax rates, where mm-hmm. the more you make, the more you pay as a percentage. And that's probably the easiest analogy for solar.
So your company, Luminol, mm-hmm. I know that it has this reputation for a commitment to the local community, particularly through its hiring practices. And I'm curious to hear more about how you, as the CEO, think about the commitment to sustainability and the creation of good jobs, especially local jobs.
Well, I'm really glad you asked me that question, because a lot of people talk about affordability and a lot of people talk about how great the technology is. Not a lot of people talk about the people who are actually physically putting the installations up. And I'd really like to hear more people talking about creating sustainable jobs, because solar is a transformative technology. But the power of a job, particularly in an urban environment, is also transformative. And in order for us to really embrace sustainability, we have to drive that adoption of clean technologies across the demographics of our urban environment and in our rural environments. One of the best ways to get people engaged is to provide opportunity for jobs. Local jobs and local job creation is a really critical part of having a sustainable economy and having a real green collar economy that mm-hmm. responds to the needs of a sustainable environment. When you create local jobs, people aren't driving as far to work.
Mm-hmm.
people are able to stay in an urban environment and work, and people are able to take care of their families. And it is a much holistic way of deploying solar.
What does a solar job look like? I think people have an idea of what some of the dirty energy jobs look like. I mean, they know what a miner does. They know sometimes what a factory worker might do. What does it look like for someone who's a solar installer?
It's hard work. You're on a roof most of the day. You're in front of an electrical panel the other parts of the day, or running conduit or pipes up and down the side of a house. It's dangerous work that requires a fair amount of training and honing your craft. So what that job looks like is you're climbing up ladders, you're racking, putting rack up, you're lagging standoffs or stanchions, posts onto a roof. It's really hard physical labor, and you're exposed to the elements. You're outside on a roof. It's great work because you get to be outside and you get to be doing something that you love. And you also are cross-learning a bunch of different skills, because what's really unique about solar installations is that you're drawing on electrical skills, you're drawing on roofing skills, you're drawing on carpentry skills. There's a lot of cross-training. And those are skills that people learn and are able to deploy in other things in their life.
How many people does your company employ in terms of the construction work? And then also, what's the bigger vision as solar expands for the potential for job creation?
So we are 18 people, and half of us do the actual physical installation, and the other half is in design and actually rebate paperwork, which is a significant amount of work. My vision for solar is that you harness not just the power of the sun, but you're actually driving targeted job creation to ensure that a broad variety of people are actually engaged in the value of providing solar. And also that we have programs like Go Solar SF in San Francisco that also target who gets the solar, so that you have a system where certain incentives might be much higher for somebody that otherwise wouldn't be able to afford solar, to enable populations that wouldn't otherwise have access to solar because maybe they have a small electric bill and they live on a very fixed income, and those individuals can get solar. So it's a much more holistic view of expanding who gets solar and who puts it up.
Right now, everyone kind of knows their local plumber, knows their local mailman, you know, knows the local UPS guy. Do you think we're going to see a day where people also know their local solar person, their solar installer, the person who comes to repair their panels?
I hope so. I think that local business and local community and small business plays a huge role in the ability for us to create the kind of jobs that are necessary in our communities for people to be able to live and provide for their families. And solar, you get really once. I guess what I'd really like to say is that one of the things that has happened in San Francisco that I think is particularly exciting is that the environmental groups led by organizations like the Sierra Club have collaborated with community-based organizations and organizations that work in neighborhoods that have historically been really harmed by industrial pollutions to provide job creation and sustainable jobs that have a future. That marrying of the environmental justice organizations with economic justice and social justice organizations is really powerful. And that is something that collaboration can move forward and do pretty amazing things. And my vision of a future is seeing how we can really see where we can harness these different technologies with the power of our local communities to be able to transform how we deliver clean electricity and how we steward our environment and our communities so that we can really provide opportunities that give people a better chance at living a life that is much more sustainable. And I think that leadership by community organizations and leadership by the Sierra Club to really drive agendas where we can collaborate in ways that can do great things is the message that I think I'd really like to deliver in terms of what solar can do.
What do you think people are most surprised to learn about solar power?
How resilient it is and how reliable it is, and that it works. It's an amazing technology. I have solar panels on my house. And in the summer, it generates, I mean, we're a net producer. We generate way more electricity than we use. And in the winter, we draw on that. And it's magical. It really is. I mean, not to sound Pollyanna-ish or silly about it, but it really is. You've got panels on your roof and you're creating electricity for the house that's using it. It's a really different way of looking at how you use electricity. And for me as a mother with kids, it's really interesting to watch them and see how they interact with it, because it's not a new thing for them to have a power plant on their roof. They understand what a kilowatt hour is. That's really empowering, because that enables, they understand that when you turn off all of the lights in the house or turn off the appliances, you can go down and you can see that you're feeding power back into the grid, and then you turn on everything in the house that you're drawing off of the grid.
That they can see it on the meter.
You can see it. You can physically see it on the meter. Mm-hmm. Normally, when you don't have a solar electric system, there's really no way to really see what you're using, to really empower yourself to make choices or to encourage your children to make choices that will be conserving electricity. And that's really powerful about solar electricity.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Janine Cotter. She's the co-founder of an urban solar installation company called Luminol. And for more information, you can visit www.luminol.com. Joining us now is Rachel Butler, the national organizer for the Sierra Club's Green Transportation Campaign. Welcome.
Thanks, Arlie.
So we wanted to talk with you a little bit about the rising trends in people who are bike commuting, biking to work. And I know that the recent Bike to Work Day was a really big success. It looks like it shows some new trends in how people are thinking about biking.
Yeah, absolutely. There are more people than ever choosing to bike, not only to get to work, but also just for regular trips that they take every day. Biking is becoming more of a transportation choice that people across the country are making. And the recent Bike to Work Day in May had millions of participants from across the country.
Now, what do you think is driving that change? Is it a pop culture thing where bikes are becoming cooler? Is it about legislation or local initiatives that are making it easier for people to bike? Or is it about high gas prices, which of course is always a driver?
Right. I think that actually it's a lot of these trends coming together. People are realizing that biking is a great way to save money. Recently, the Sierra Club put out a new report with the League of American Bicyclists and the National Council of La Raza showing that Americans can together save about $4.6 billion a year by biking rather than by driving. And for many trips, actually are less than 2 miles. So that's a perfect biking distance. And with high gas prices, people wanting opportunities to get out there and use safe and healthy transportation options, biking is a great one, and cities are starting to pay attention and provide better and safer biking infrastructure to make our communities more bike-friendly and more people-friendly.
Do you find that you're seeing that this is a trend nationwide? Is it really just in certain cities?
I would say it's definitely a trend nationwide. There are some cities that are really taking the lead over others in terms of making their cities better places to bike. And those cities range from really cold places like Minneapolis to some of the more usual suspects in terms of Portland is always a shining example that gets rated as a platinum bike-friendly city by the League of American Bicyclists. I actually have a map in front of my desk that shows the different cities where bike shares are popping up across the country, and there are some surprising candidates on there. We've got bike shares popping up in Chattanooga, in Nashville, in Austin, in San Antonio, in Miami Beach and Broward County in Florida. It's really across the map. There are bike shares popping up because this is a transportation choice that people want and people are demanding it.
And now tell us more about these bike share programs. How do they work in general?
So right now, the country's largest bike share program is operating in Washington, D.C., and it's pretty easy. What you do is you sign up to become a member of the bike share system. You get a key fob, essentially, that you walk up to a station that's distributed across the city. You swipe your little key fob on a reader, and that unlocks a bike for you. So at that point, you take the bike out of the station, you ride across town to your destination, and you put the bike back. And usually, if you're a member of the bike share, any trip under half an hour for most systems across the country is free. So it's a great way to get around. You don't have to worry about locking up the bike. You just put it right back in the station when you're done.
And do you have to take it back to the place that it came from, or could you drop it off in one place and then walk home?
You could pick it up one place, drop it off another place. You can walk home, take transit home. That's part of the beauty of bike share, is that you don't always have to have the bike with you. You can use it when you need it, and that's what makes biking so convenient.
Are there any numbers about the percentage increase in people who are bike commuting now versus last year or a few years ago?
Yeah, bike trips have been increasing. Between 2000 and 2010, the number of bike commuters grew 40% nationwide.
Wow.
And that growth is even greater for bike-friendly communities, up to 77% growth between 2000 and 2010 for bike-friendly communities identified by the League of American Bicyclists. And also, what's really great to note is that rates of biking over the period of 2001 to 2009 has been increasing faster among Latino, African American, and Asian American communities than it has among other communities in the U.S.
So these increases are really promising. 40% increase in bike commuting, you know, over 70% in some cities. What's it going to take to really jumpstart this and see a 1,000% increase or a 10,000% increase?
Well, really, it's about building the right kind of infrastructure, building bicycle-friendly communities where it's safe to get on a bike, whether you're 8 years old or whether you're 80, for, you know, biking, making biking safe for grandkids and grandmothers. That's what it's really going to take to make rates of biking, both for commuting, for going to the grocery store, really take off and really explode. And so it's really about rethinking the way that we're designing our communities to make them more about the needs of people rather than the needs of getting cars around. That's, I think, really going to make biking take off.
Thanks so much. You've been listening to Rachel Butler. She's the national organizer for the Sierra Club's Green Transportation Program. Joining us now in our studio is Avital Andrews, the Green Living Editor at Sierra Magazine. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Arlie.
So today we're going to talk about this feature in the new Sierra Magazine. You talk about this issue of like eco-friendly fast foods, mm-hmm. which I thought was really interesting because people often don't think fast food could ever be green mm-hmm. in any way. So what made you decide to do this topic, and how did you pick some of the, you know, fast foods that might be a little bit more green than others?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you're right. Fast food is not eco-friendly almost in any way. But the thing that I try to do when I write these stories is find something that, you know, people are going to do anyway, even if they're green. You know, occasionally you're still going to go to a fast food restaurant or stop in a drive-thru. So we wanted to let people know what their options are, what the best, kind of the lesser of all the evils at each of these places are.
So if you have to pick your poison, which one do you go for?
Exactly. And what we do for these kinds of stories is we ask an array of experts in whatever food we're writing about. So we asked 5 different experts in fast food what their favorite eco-friendly food option is. And I would say that Chipotle came out as the big star, although each one did recommend a separate one. But just kind of getting into the research of this, Chipotle is really the leader of the pack when it comes to this. And then I added a couple of my own editor's picks as well, just from my research.
And so why does Chipotle come out on top? Like, if you have to go for fast food, what is it about Chipotle that's green or better than some of these other brands?
Yeah, and I want to reiterate that it's definitely not perfect, but they're trying really hard. They really place a strong emphasis on local ingredients, which is rare for a fast food chain. Mm-hmm. They define local as ingredients that are grown or produced 350 miles from a restaurant, and they do try to source as many ingredients as possible from this distance. They also work with family farms. They actually have people whose job it is to go to these farms and forge relationships with family farmers. And the reason they say they do that is because family farmers tend to care better for their land because it's the only land they have. So mm-hmm. they'll be more likely to rotate crops, plant different crops, avoid pesticides, and just generally farm in a more sustainable way. They also have great vegetarian options. And that's something we'll get into with other places as well.
Now, what about some of the other picks here besides Chipotle? If you've got to go for fast food, what are some better options?
A guy named Jay Freelander, who used to be the COO of a place called Stonyfield Cafe, and now he directs the Sustainable Business Program at the College of the Atlantic. He recommended the French fries from Five Guys, which is a big chain on the East Coast. We've got some here on the West Coast, too. But he says that when he needs a fast food fix, he indulges himself on Five Guys French fries. And he admits they're hardly healthy, but they're vegan. And the place doesn't use freezers, which is big for global warming purposes. Mm-hmm. And they don't process, and they minimize their energy input. And the packaging, he says, is just a paper cup and an unbleached paper bag, and they taste great. So, you know, French fries, if you're looking for a vegan option, they're not great for your body, but they're better on the planet than, say, a hamburger or chicken McNuggets.
And I think people also might not realize, that it's also that if they're vegan, they're fried in oil that's not also used for all of the animal products. Is that correct?
Correct, yeah. They can't call it vegan unless it is. And, there are some places where a food might look vegetarian, but it's not. For example, Taco Bell actually uses lard in all of its beans, which you would assume were vegetarian, but they're not even vegetarian. They have
animal products.
So, yeah.
What about some of the other products here?
So there's a chain called Panera. I think it's big on the West Coast. I don't know how many there are on the East Coast or in the middle of the country, but a guy named Marcus Giuliano recommended this. He's sort of a natural chef. He owns an organic restaurant in New York. And he said that he doesn't typically go for fast food, but when he does, it's to Panera. And for a chain, he says, they're very accommodating and have no problem pulling out a huge 3-ring binder that lists all the menu items with ingredients. So he usually chooses the black bean soup and the Greek salad without feta because he prefers to eat vegan. So those two options have him covered. And he also likes that they use washable real dishes as opposed to one-time use throwaways.
So I think we do need to note that we're not recommending everybody go eat more fast food, but we do recognize at Sierra Club Radio that every once in a while you have to make a choice you might not want to make, and so you might as well try to pick the better option.
That's exactly the point, yes.
All right, well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Avital Andrews. She is the Green Living Editor at Sierra Magazine.
Thank you, Orly.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
This chap here, he thinks he can tell you the future. His name is Nostradamus, although here the sun have made him look a little bit like Sean Connery. And like most of you, I suspect, I don't really believe that people can see into the future. I don't believe in precognition. And every now and then you hear that somebody has been able to predict something that happened in the future, and that's probably because it was a fluke. And we only hear about the flukes and about the freaks. We don't hear about all the times that people got stuff wrong. Now, we expect that to happen with silly stories about precognition. But the problem is, we have exactly the same problem in academia and in medicine. And in this environment, it costs lives. So firstly, thinking just about precognition, as it turns out, just last year, a researcher called Daryl Bem conducted a piece of research where he found evidence of precognitive powers in undergraduate students. And this was published in a peer-reviewed academic journal, and most of the people who read this just said, okay, well, fair enough, but I think that's a fluke, that's a freak. Because I know that if I did a study where I found no evidence that undergraduate students had precognitive powers, it probably wouldn't get published in a journal. And in fact, we know that that's true because several different groups of research scientists tried to replicate the findings of this precognition study, and when they submitted it to the exact same journal, the journal said, no, we're not interested in publishing replication. We're not interested in your negative data. So this is already evidence of how, in the academic literature, we will see a biased sample of the true picture of all of the scientific studies that have been conducted. But it doesn't just happen in the dry academic field of psychology. It also happens in, for example, cancer research. So in March 2012, just 1 month ago, some researchers reported in the journal Nature how they had tried to replicate 53 different basic science studies looking at potential treatment targets in cancer. And out of those 53 studies, they were only able to successfully replicate six. 47 out of those 53 were unreplicable. And they say in their discussion that this is very likely because freaks get published. People will do lots and lots and lots of different studies, and the occasions when it works, they will publish, and the ones where it doesn't work, they won't. And their first recommendation of how to fix this problem, because it is a problem, because it sends us all down blind alleys, their first recommendation of how to fix this problem is to make it easier to publish negative results in science and to change the incentives so that scientists are encouraged to post more of their negative results in public. But it doesn't just happen in the very dry world of preclinical basic science cancer research. It also happens in the very real flesh and blood of academic medicine. So in 1980, some researchers did a study on a drug called Lorcanide, and this was an antiarrhythmic drug, a drug that suppresses abnormal heart rhythms. And the idea was, after people have had a heart attack, they're quite likely to have abnormal heart rhythms, so if we give them a drug that suppresses abnormal heart rhythms, this will increase the chances of them surviving. Early on in its development, they did a very small trial, just under 100 patients. 50 patients got Lorcanide, and of those patients, 10 died. Another 50 patients got a dummy placebo sugar pill with no active ingredient, and only one of them died. So they rightly regarded this drug as a failure, and its commercial development was stopped. And because its commercial development was stopped, this trial was never published. Unfortunately, over the course of the next 5-10 years, other companies had the same idea about drugs that would prevent arrhythmias in people who've had heart attacks. These drugs were brought to market. They were prescribed very widely because heart attacks are a very common thing. And it took so long for us to find out that these drugs also caused an increased rate of death that before we detected that safety signal, over 100,000 people died unnecessarily in America from the prescription of antiarrhythmic drugs. Now, actually, in 1993, the researchers who did that 1980 study, that early study, published a mea culpa, an apology to the scientific community, in which they said, when we carried out our study in 1980, we thought that the increased death rate that occurred in the Lorcanide group was an effect of chance. The development of Lorcanide was abandoned for commercial reasons, and this study was never published. It's now a good example of publication bias. That's the technical term for the phenomenon where unflattering data gets lost, gets unpublished, is left missing in action. And they say the results described here might have provided an early warning of trouble ahead. Now, these are stories from basic science. These are stories from 20, 30 years ago. The academic publishing environment is very different now. There are academic journals like Trials, the open access journal, which will publish any trial conducted in humans, regardless of whether it has a positive or a negative result. But this problem of negative results that go missing in action is still very prevalent. In fact, it's so prevalent that it cuts to the core of evidence-based medicine. So this is a drug called reboxetine, and this is a drug that I myself have prescribed. It's an antidepressant. And I'm a very nerdy doctor, so I read all of the studies that I could on this drug. I read the one study that was published that showed that reboxetine was better than placebo, and I read the other three studies that were published that showed that reboxetine was just as good as any other antidepressant. And because this patient hadn't done well on those other antidepressants, I thought, well, reboxetine's just as good. It's one to try. But it turned out that I was misled. In fact, seven trials were conducted comparing reboxetine against a dummy placebo sugar pill. One of them was positive, and that was published, but six of them were negative, and they were left unpublished. Three trials were published comparing reboxetine against other antidepressants, in which reboxetine was just as good, and they were published, but three times as many patients' worth of data was collected, which showed that reboxetine was worse than those other treatments, and those trials were not published. I felt misled. Now, you might say, well, that's an extreme and unusual example, and I wouldn't want to be guilty of the same kind of cherry-picking and selective referencing that I'm accusing other people of. But it turns out that this phenomenon of publication bias has actually been very, very well studied. So here is one example of how you approach it. The classic model is you get a bunch of studies where you know that they've been conducted and completed, and then you go and see if they've been published anywhere in the academic literature. So this took all of the trials that had ever been conducted on antidepressants that were approved over a 15-year period by the FDA. They took all of the trials which were submitted to the FDA as part of the approval package. So that's not all of the trials that were ever conducted on these drugs, because we can never know if we have those, but it is the ones that were conducted in order to get the marketing authorization. And then they went to see if these trials had been published in the peer-reviewed academic literature. And this is what they found. It was pretty much a 50-50 split. Half of these trials were positive, half of them were negative, in reality. But when they went to look for these trials in the peer-reviewed academic literature, what they found was a very different picture. Only three of the negative trials were published, but all but one of the positive trials were published. Now, if we just flick back and forth between those two, you can see what a staggering difference there was between reality and what doctors, patients, commissioners of health services, and academics were able to see in the peer-reviewed academic literature. We were misled. And this is a systematic flaw in the core of medicine. In fact, there have been so many studies conducted on publication bias now, over 100, that they've been collected in a systematic review, published in 2010, that took every single study on publication bias that they could find. Publication bias affects every field of medicine. About half of all trials, on average, go missing in action. And we know that positive findings are around twice as likely to be published as negative findings. This is a cancer at the core of evidence-based medicine. If I flipped a coin 100 times, but then withheld the results from you from half of those tosses, I could make it look as if I had a coin that always came up heads. But that wouldn't mean that I had a two-headed coin. That would mean that I was a chancer and you were an idiot for letting me get away with it. But this is exactly what we blindly tolerate in the whole of evidence-based medicine. And to me, this is research misconduct. If I conducted one study and I withheld half of the data points from that one study, you would rightly accuse me, essentially, of research fraud. And yet, for some reason, if somebody conducts 10 studies but only publishes the five that give the result that they want, we don't consider that to be research misconduct. And when that responsibility is diffused between a whole network of researchers, academics, industry sponsors, journal editors, for some reason we find it more acceptable. But the effect on patients is damning. And this is happening right now, today. This is a drug called Tamiflu. Tamiflu is a drug which governments around the world have spent billions and billions of dollars on stockpiling. And we've stockpiled Tamiflu in panic, in the belief that it will reduce the rate of complications of influenza. Complications is a medical euphemism for pneumonia and death. Now, when the Cochrane systematic reviewers were trying to collect together all of the data from all of the trials that had ever been conducted on whether Tamiflu actually did this or not, they found that several of those trials were unpublished. The results were unavailable to them. And when they started obtaining the write-ups of those trials through various different means, through Freedom of Information Act requests, through harassing various different organizations, what they found was inconsistent. And when they tried to get hold of the clinical study reports, the 10,000-page-long documents that have the best possible rendition of the information, they were told they weren't allowed to have them. And if you want to read the full correspondence and the excuses and the explanations given by the drug company, you can see that written up in this week's edition of PLOS Medicine. And the most staggering thing of all of this, to me, is that not only is this a problem, not only do we recognize that this is a problem, but we've had to suffer fake fixes. We've had people pretend that this is a problem that's been fixed. First of all, we had trials registers, and everybody said, oh, it's okay, we'll get everyone to register their trials, they'll post the protocol, they'll say what they're going to do before they do it, and then afterwards we'll be able to check and see if all the trials which have been conducted and completed have been published. But people didn't bother to use those registers, and so then the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors came along, and they said, oh, well, we will hold the line, we won't publish any journals, we won't publish any trials unless they've been registered before they began. But they didn't hold the line. In 2008, a study was conducted which showed that half of all the trials published by journals edited by members of the ICMJE weren't properly registered, and a quarter of them weren't registered at all. And then finally, the FDA Amendment Act was passed a couple of years ago saying that everybody who conducts a trial must post the results of that trial within 1 year. And in the BMJ, in the first edition of January 2012, you can see a study which looks to see if people kept to that ruling, and it turns out that only 1 in 5 have done so. This is a disaster. We cannot know the true effects of the medicines that we prescribe if we do not have access to all of the information. And this is not a difficult problem to fix. We need to force people to publish all trials conducted in humans, including the older trials, because the FDA Amendment Act only asks that you publish the trials conducted after 2008, and I don't know what world it is in which we're only practicing medicine on the basis of trials that completed in the past 2 years. We need to publish all trials in humans, including the older trials, for all drugs in current use. And you need to tell everyone you know that this is a problem and that it has not been fixed. Thank you very much.
I want to talk to you today about something the open source programming world can teach democracy. But before that, a little preamble. Let's start here. This is Martha Payne. Martha's a 9-year-old Scot who lives in the Council of Argyle and Butte. A couple months ago, Payne started a food blog called Never Seconds. And she would take her camera with her every day to school to document her school lunches. Can you spot the vegetable? And as sometimes happens, this blog acquired first dozens of readers, and then hundreds of readers, and then thousands of readers as people tuned in to watch her rate her school lunches, including on my favorite category, pieces of hair found in food. This was a 0 day, so that's good. And then 2 weeks ago yesterday, she posted this, a post that read, "Goodbye." And she said, "I'm very sorry to tell you this, but my head teacher pulled me out of class today and told me I'm not allowed to take pictures in the lunchroom anymore. I really enjoyed doing this. Thank you for reading. Goodbye." You can guess what happened next. Right? The outrage was so swift, so voluminous, so unanimous that the Council of Argyle and Butte reversed themselves the same day and said, we would never censor a 9-year-old. You know, except, of course, this morning. And this brings up the question, what made them think they could get away with something like that? And the answer is, all of human history prior to now. So, what happens when a medium suddenly puts a lot of new ideas into circulation? Now, this isn't just a contemporaneous question. This is something we've faced several times over the last few centuries. When the telegraph came along, it was clear that it was going to globalize the news industry. What would this lead to? Well, obviously, it would lead to world peace. the television, a medium that allowed us not just to hear, but see, literally see what was going on elsewhere in the world. What would this lead to? World peace. The telephone? You guessed it, world peace. Sorry for the spoiler alert, but no world peace, not yet. Even the printing press was assumed to be a tool that was going to enforce Catholic intellectual hegemony across Europe. Instead, what we got was Martin Luther's 95 Theses, the Protestant Reformation, and, you know, the 30 Years' War. Right? So what all of these predictions of world peace got right is that when a lot of new ideas suddenly come into circulation, it changes society. But what they got exactly wrong was what happens next. The more ideas there are in circulation, the more ideas there are for any individual to disagree with. More media always means more arguing. That's what happens when the media space expands. And yet, when we look back on the printing press in the early years, we like what happened. We are a pro-printing press society. So how do we square those two things? That it leads to more arguing, but we think it was good. And the answer, I think, can be found in things like this. This is the cover of Philosophical Transactions, the first scientific journal ever published in English in the middle of the 1600s. And it was created by a group of people who'd been calling themselves the Invisible College, a group of natural philosophers who only later would call themselves scientists. And they wanted to improve the way natural philosophers argued with each other. And they needed to do two things for this. They needed openness. They needed to create a norm which said when you do an experiment, you have to publish not just your claims, but how you did the experiment. If you don't tell us how you did it, we won't trust you. But the other thing they needed was speed. They had to quickly synchronize what other natural philosophers knew, otherwise you couldn't get the right kind of argument going. The printing press was clearly the right medium for this, but the book was the wrong tool. It was too slow. And so they invented the scientific journal as a way of synchronizing the argument across the community of natural scientists. The scientific revolution wasn't created by the printing press. It was created by scientists, but it couldn't have been created if they didn't have a printing press as a tool. So what about us? What about our generation and our media revolution, the internet? Well, predictions of world peace, check. More arguing, gold star on that one. I mean, YouTube is just a gold mine. Better arguing? That's the question. So I study social media, which means to a first approximation, I watch people argue. And if I had to pick a group that I think is our invisible college, is our generation's collection of people trying to take these tools and to press it into service, not for more arguments, but for better arguments, I'd pick the open source programmers. Programming is a three-way relationship between a programmer, some source code, and the computer it's meant to run on. But computers are such famously inflexible interpreters of instructions that it's extraordinarily difficult to write out a set of instructions that the computer knows how to execute. And that's if one person is writing it. Once you get more than one person writing it, it's very easy for any two programmers to overwrite each other's work if they're working on the same file, or to send incompatible instructions that simply causes the computer to choke. And this problem grows larger the more programmers are involved. Right. To a first approximation, the problem of managing a large software project is the problem of keeping this social chaos at bay. Now, for decades, there has been a canonical solution to this problem, which is to use something called a version control system. And a version control system does what it says on the tin. It provides a canonical copy of the software on a server somewhere. The only programmers who can change it are people who've specifically been given permission to access it, and they're only allowed to access the subsection of it that they have permission to change. And when people draw diagrams of version control systems, the diagrams always look something like this. Right? They look like org charts. And you don't have to squint very hard to see the political ramifications of a system like this. This is feudalism. One owner, many workers. Now, that's fine for the commercial software industry. It really is Microsoft's Office. It's Adobe's Photoshop. The corporation owns the software. The programmers come and go. But there was one programmer who decided that this wasn't the way to work. This is Linus Torvalds. Torvalds is the most famous open source programmer, created Linux, obviously. And Torvalds looked at the way the open source movement had been dealing with this problem. Open source software, the core promise of the open source license, is that everybody should have access to all the source code all the time. But of course, this creates the very threat of chaos you have to forestall in order to get anything working. So most open source projects just held their noses and adopted the feudal management systems. But Torvalds said, no, I'm not going to do that. His point of view on this was very clear. When you adopt a tool, you also adopt the management philosophy embedded in that tool. And he wasn't going to adopt anything that didn't work the way the Linux community worked. And to give you a sense of how enormous a decision like this was, this is a map of the internal dependencies within Linux, within the Linux operating system. Which subparts of the program rely on which other subparts to get going. This is a tremendously complicated process. This is a tremendously complicated program. And yet for years, Torvalds ran this, not with automated tools, but out of his email box. People would literally mail him changes that they'd agreed on, and he would merge them by hand. And then, 15 years after looking at Linux and figuring out how the community worked, he said, I think I know how to write a version control system for free people. And he called it Git. Git is distributed version control. It has two big differences with traditional version control systems. The first is that it lives up to the philosophical promise of open source. Everybody who works on a project has access to all of the source code all of the time. And when people draw diagrams of Git workflow, they use drawings that look like this. And you don't have to understand what the circles and boxes and arrows mean to see that this is a far more complicated way of working than is supported by ordinary version control systems. But this is also the thing that brings the chaos back. And this is Git's second big innovation. This is a screenshot from GitHub, the premier Git hosting service. And every time a programmer uses Git to make any important change at all, creating a new file, modifying an existing one, merging two files, Git creates this kind of signature, this long string of numbers and letters here, is a unique identifier tied to every single change. But without any central coordination, every Git system generates this number the same way, which means this is a signature tied directly and unforgeably to a particular change. This has the following effect. A programmer in Edinburgh and a programmer in Tebe can both get a copy of the same piece of software. Each of them can make changes, and they can merge them after the fact, even if they didn't know of each other's existence beforehand. This is cooperation without coordination. This is the big change. Now, I tell you all of this not to convince you that it's great that open source programmers now have a tool that supports their philosophical way of working, although I think that is great. I tell you all of this because of what I think it means for the way communities come together. Once Git allowed for cooperation without coordination, you start to see communities form that are enormously large and complex. Right? This is a graph of the Ruby community. It's an open source programming language. And all of the interconnections between the people, this is now not a software graph, but a people graph, all of the interconnections among the people working on that project. Right? And this doesn't look like an org chart. This looks like a disorg chart. And yet, out of this community, but using these tools, they can now create something together. So there are two good reasons to think that this kind of technique can be applied to democracies in general, and in particular to the law. When you make the claim, in fact, that something on the internet is going to be good for democracy, you often get this reaction. Which is, are you talking about the thing with the singing cats? Like, is that the thing you think is going to be good for society? To which I have to say, here's the thing with the singing cats. That always happens. Right? And I don't just mean that always happens with the internet. I mean that always happens with media, full stop. It did not take long after the rise of the commercial printing press before someone figured out that erotic novels were a good idea. You don't have to have an economic incentive to sell books very long before someone says, hey, you know what I bet people would pay for? It took people another 150 years to even think of the scientific journal, right? So the harnessing by the Invisible College of the printing press to create the scientific journal was phenomenally important. But it didn't happen big, and it didn't happen quick, and it didn't happen fast. So if you're going to look for where the change is happening, you have to look on the margins. So the law is also dependency related. This is a graph of the U.S. tax code and the dependencies of one law on other laws for the overall effect. So there's that as a site for source code management. But there's also the fact that the law is another place where there are many opinions in circulation, but they need to be resolved to one canonical copy. And when you go onto GitHub and you look around, there are millions and millions of projects, almost all of which are source code, but if you look around the edges, you can see people experimenting with the political ramifications of a system like that. Someone put up all the WikiLeaks cables from the State Department, along with software used to interpret them, including my favorite use ever of the CableGate cables, which is a tool for detecting naturally occurring haiku in State Department prose. The New York Senate has put up something called open legislation, also hosted on GitHub, again, for all of the reasons of updating and fluidity. You can go and pick your senator, and then you can see a list of bills they have sponsored. Someone going by DiveGeek has put up the Utah Code, the laws of the state of Utah, and they've put it up there not just to distribute the code, but with the very interesting possibility that this could be used to further the development of legislation. Somebody put up a tool during the copyright debate last year in the Senate, saying, it's strange that Hollywood has more access to Canadian legislators than Canadian citizens do. Why don't we use GitHub to show them what a citizen-developed bill might look like? And it includes this very evocative screenshot. This is called a diff, this thing on the right here. This shows you, for text that many people are editing, when a change was made, who made it, and what the change is. The stuff in red is the stuff that got deleted. The stuff in the green is the stuff that got added. Programmers take this capability for granted. No democracy anywhere in the world offers this feature to its citizens for either legislation or for budgets, even though those are the things done with our consent and with our money. Right. Now, I would love to tell you that the fact that the open source programmers have worked out a collaborative method that is large-scale, distributed, cheap, and in sync with the ideals of democracy. I would love to tell you that because those tools are in place, the innovation is inevitable. But it's not. Part of the problem, of course, is just a lack of information. Somebody put a question up on Quora saying, why is it that lawmakers don't use distributed version control? This, graphically, was the answer. Right. That is indeed part of the problem, but only part. Right. The bigger problem, of course, is power. The people experimenting with participation don't have legislative power, and the people who have legislative power are not experimenting with participation. They are experimenting with openness. There's no democracy worth the name that doesn't have a transparency movement. But transparency is openness in only one direction. And being given a dashboard without a steering wheel has never been the core promise a democracy makes to its citizens. So consider this. The thing that got Martha Payne's opinions out into the public was a piece of technology. But the thing that kept them there was political will. It was the expectation of the citizens that she would not be censored. Right? That's now the state we're in with these collaboration tools. We have them. We've seen them. they work. Can we use them? Can we apply the techniques that worked here to this? T.S. Eliot once said, one of the most momentous things that can happen to a culture is that they acquire a new form of prose. I think that's wrong, but I think it's right for argumentation, right? A momentous thing that can happen to a culture is they can acquire a new style of arguing. Trial by jury, voting, peer review, now this. A new form of arguing has been invented in our lifetimes, in the last decade, in fact. It's large, it's distributed, it's low cost, and it's compatible with the ideals of democracy. The question for us now is, are we going to let the programmers keep it to themselves, or are we going to try and take it and press it into service for society at large? Thank you for listening. Thank you.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students. The WHFR Monday Forum, an hour of a wide variety of one or more talk show programs from 6 to 7 p.m., some of which are locally produced.
Today turns into yesterday, leaving only words we say for this time.
New ideas and information, different each week, not available on other Detroit stations. That's why we're the station making waves, WHFR.fm. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to WHFR at hfcc.edu.